Excuse me, this conference is being recorded. If anyone has any objections, you may disconnect at this time. You may begin.
Thank you very much. A couple details about our presentation today. We have a PDF file. There isn't a PowerPoint available. There's just the PDF, so that's what you need to download. And there are a number of movies that will be referenced during the presentation. Okay, so our speaker today is Brent Buffington of the Cassini Navigation Team here at JPL. And Brent, along with others, were responsible for designing the Cassini Orbital Tour that will hopefully take us to 2017 and the end of the Cassini mission. And Brent is also working on the upcoming, hopefully upcoming, Jupiter Europa Orbiter, JEO, mission. Brent went to school, I didn't know this, but in two really nice places, the University of Montana and then for his undergraduate, and then graduate school at the University of Colorado, where he got a master's degree in aerospace engineering, and presumably that's where he honed his skills on all this orbital mechanics stuff that he's going to describe today. I sent out a link to a really interesting New York Times article that profiled Brent and the two other tour designers, Dave Seal and John Smith. That's a real interesting article. If you haven't had a chance to read it, you should do that. I wanted to mention that, you know, it's rare at our Cassini science meetings that any one group of people gets a round of applause by the Cassini scientists, but the tour designers always do. I mean, they're able to accomplish all this great science, juggle all the science requirements, make them all fit within, you know, the laws of physics and the engineering constraints that they have. And the Cassini scientists are always blown away by what they can accomplish. So Brent looks like he has a really nice presentation. He's going to tell us today how this all works. And the title of his talk is Trajectory Design in the Saturnian System. So Brent.
All right, thanks, Marcia. And again, yeah, I just want to reiterate that I've included, in addition to this PDF, I've included a number of animations to aid in the explaining of certain aspects of trajectory design. So anytime I'm going to use one of these and talk to one, I'll give you guys a heads up and give you a little time to load them up. They're all QuickTime movies. On each slide that I will talk to, there's also a little note saying that, you know, see animation with a name. So it should be pretty straightforward, but nonetheless, I'll try and give you some time to load those up. If I don't, just holler. All right, so again, yeah, I'm going to be talking about trajectory design in the Saturnian system. So let's go ahead and get started. So going to slide three. So just starting from square one, formal definition of a trajectory is a path described by a projectile flying or an object moving under the action of given forces. For today's discussion, the projectile is going to be the Cassini spacecraft, and the forces acting on the spacecraft are dominated by the gravity of Saturn and its moons, although other forces are modeled when we actually fly the trajectory. So below is just a graphic showing Cassini's prime mission in gray, with the orbits of the largest eight Saturn moons shown in a greenish blue. So moving to the next slide, continuing with the background information. So Cassini was launched October 15th, 1997, then followed the green path to the first Venus swingby in April of 1998, then followed the red path, where it performed a deep space maneuver in December 1998, about, I think, 650, 649 meters per second, I believe, then had a second Venus flyby in June 1999, and then an outbound Earth swing by on the blue path in August of 1999, finally swinging by Jupiter in December of 2000, and then lastly arriving at Saturn on July 1st, 2004. So, Cassini is the fourth spacecraft to reach Saturn and the first spacecraft to orbit around the planet Saturn. So, moving to the next slide, just a quick summary of what we've done in the past. So, the prime mission first. Prime mission ran from July 2004 to July 2008. It was the most complicated gravity assist trajectory ever flown. Consists of 45 Titan flybys, 10 close icy satellite flybys, four of which were Enceladus, 75 orbits around Saturn, 161 planned maneuvers. Of those 161, 112 were executed. We delivered the European Space Agency's Huygens probe to the surface of Titan in January 2005. And overall, just sustained a staggering pace of science discovery with well over 1,000 independent publications and prominent science journals, not to mention all the engineering conference papers and journal papers that we've written on the project side of things. Data from Cassini's spacecraft has led to numerous discoveries, which, you know, just to list a few, include water ice and vapor geysers in the south polar region in the Small Moon Enceladus, an active hydrocarbon hydrological cycle at Titan, verify the continued existence of a perplexing hexagon-shaped structure near Saturn's north pole, first observed by Voyager 1, and a number of new, highly complex dynamic structures in our solar system's most massive and diverse ring system. So going to the next slide, based on this, you know, the continued quality of science return, NASA headquarters granted two extended missions. And again, this is predicated on the quality of science return, but also the spacecraft's excellent state of health. All subsystems and instruments remained healthy. We had a substantial consumable margins, or they were maintained, and power levels from the radioisotope thermal electric generators allowed for many, many more years of science operations. So the first extension is referred to as the Equinox mission, since it carried Cassini through Saturn's north hemisphere vernal equinox. And even though the Equinox mission was technically an extension, it was far more similar in scope and funding to the Prime mission. Science observations and the related navigation and spacecraft operations continued at the same or even greater pace than the Prime mission. So in all, the Equinox mission included 28 Titan flybys, 11 icy satellite flybys, 8 of which were of Enceladus, 64 Saturn orbits, and 104 planned maneuvers, where about or 70 of them were executed. The second extension, running from October 2010 to September 2017, is referred to the Solstice mission, and I'll get into a little more of that detail here in a second. But this extension required a radical change in design methodology. And moving to the next slide, slide 7, and this is because the Solstice mission's overriding scientific goal was to reach Saturn's northern summer solstice, which is May 2017. So essentially what we have to do is more than double the total mission duration while only having an annual propellant budget of 22% of the Prime and Equinox missions. Furthermore, a 40% reduction in staffing would limit the frequency of key events and as well as the complexity of observational sequences. Other design challenges of the Solstice mission, we had to design a 7-year tour with the same schedule as a 2-year extension, so the same schedule as the Equinox mission. We only had 2 mission designers instead of 3, like we had for the Equinox mission. And lastly, since the Solstice mission will govern the remainder of Cassini's operational lifetime at Saturn, sufficient spacecraft disposal scenario had to be implemented, which met planetary protection requirements. And I'll go into a lot more detail about this here at the very end of the presentation, how we plan to get rid of the spacecraft once we're out of propellant. So moving on to slide 8. The players, so the 2 main groups involved in the iterative process of designing the Solstice mission were the tour designers, John Smith and myself, and then the other group was the project science group, which is, you know, 200 plus scientists from 17, maybe even 18 countries now, I think, and they comprise 12 instrument teams and 5 discipline working groups, where those 5 working groups are MAPS, Saturn, rings, Titan, and icy satellites. So with this defined and kind of the background defined, let's go ahead and look in a little more detail at the actual trajectory design process itself. So moving to slide 9. So the process of designing a trajectory is bound by the laws of physics and driven by science intrigue. Going to the next slide, our goal on paper is pretty simple. It's simply to maximize the number of high-quality science objectives while minimizing propellant expenditure and adhering to operational spacecraft and environmental constraints. Trying to figure out exactly what this means and what this really entails, we're going to look at the trajectory development process itself. So we're going to slide 11. So here's just a flow chart, the end-to-end process, starting with some initial conditions and ending with science return, which again is the main purpose of doing this. The whole reason we're doing it is to get good science. So moving to the next slide. So the first thing, again, is initial conditions, which is essentially just a position of velocity at some time. In our case, our starting point is simply the ending conditions of the Equinox mission, which was a short period, 16 days, moderately inclined, about 19-degree orbit, and it had a pretty close periapsis distance, about 3 RS. For other missions, this could be a launch date from Earth, an encounter from an asteroid, et cetera. So the next thing is the requested scientific observation. So this is what drove our design. This is kind of the wish list from the scientist. So going to the next slide to look at this in a little more detail, there's over 40 science objectives to guide the SOLSTICE mission, and they address two major themes. The first, seasonal and temporal change, and the second were new questions that have arisen since the start of the mission. And just to give a handful of examples of each category, as far as seasonal change, they were interested in variability in Enceladus plumes, its temperature, surface temperature, and surface morphology. Definitely interested in variability in Titan's methane hydrocarbon hydrological cycle, Saturn's temperature, clouds, and composition, and time variability and numerous ring phenomena. As far as new questions, some that were asked were, the types, composition, distribution, and age of Titan's surface and features, the life cycle of Saturn's south polar hurricane. They're asking questions, how are narrow gaps in the rings cleared? Does Rhea have rings, et cetera? And again, there's 40, over 40 of these to define the mission. But again, the overall goal was to reach Saturn's summer solstice in May of 2017. So looking at the next slide, it's just this is a nice little diagram that Dave Seal put together just showing the seasonal cycles at Saturn. So when we arrived in July 2004, we were near the mid to end part of the winter season in the northern hemisphere of Saturn. The extended mission, again, took us through the vernal equinox, and the planned extended mission, or the solstice mission, should take us all the way through summer solstice of May 2017. All right, so the next tier has to do with constraints on the trajectory itself, so we weren't free to do whatever the heck we wanted. There were numerous constraints that we had to adhere to and not violate in order to get the spacecraft to 2017. So moving to slide 17, first, environmental constraints, dust hazard. So, while the solar system's most massive and diverse ring system is one of intrigue from a scientific point of view, much of the system, the main rings, clearly are not are too hazardous to navigate. So specifically, we need to avoid crossing the main ring system, which is shown in that graphic, which is very clear. That's about 1.08 RS to 2.35 RS, and then we also had to avoid the core of the G ring. Now notice there's two places, so we're free essentially to cross this ring plane within the main ring system, and I'm going to go in a little more detail about the definition of this gap that we think is clear in the inner part of the ring system, so between the inner D ring or the inner main ring system and the upper atmosphere of Saturn. We can also pass between that outer edge of the main ring system, the F ring, and the G ring. And we've done this numerous times over the mission. And then also, the E-ring is very diffuse. It stems from Enceladus, the plumes of Enceladus, but it's very diffuse, and we fly through it all the time and don't really have to worry about hurting the spacecraft through the E-ring. So moving to the next slide, still in environmental constraints, now to atmosphere and plumes. So first, Titan. So Titan is completely enshrouded in methane, dense methane atmosphere, which is, again, one of the main reasons we went there, to investigate it. And in-situ instruments want to go as deep as possible to sample this atmosphere. But that atmosphere also imparts torque to the spacecraft, and that needs to be counteracted with our reaction control system thrusters. And since we have a finite control authority, that does limit how deep we can go. So through the entire mission, the typical minimum Titan flyby altitudes range between 950 and 1,050 kilometers. They obviously go much, much higher, but those are the minimum altitudes. And throughout the entire mission, T-70 was the lowest flyby, and that was at 880 kilometers. For Enceladus, the minimum flyby altitude was set to 75 kilometers. If we were passing directly through the plume, so if we had a closest approach latitude less than about 70 degrees south, we had to stay at or above 75 kilometers, and then anywhere else on the disk, closest approach could be at 50 kilometers. So now moving into the operational and spacecraft constraints for the next slide. Since, again, there would be a reduction in staff on the order of about 40%, the frequency of key events, i.e. labor-intensive events, had to be scaled back. And so the main things that we tracked were the time of flight between flybys, maneuver frequency, and spacecraft periods. We had to space these out much more. We tried to double the frequency or double the amount of time between key events versus the prime and Equinox mission. And as I already mentioned, the mission duration was fixed at about 7 years. We had to deal with solar conjunctions. We didn't want any key periods or key events going on during solar conjunction. And then the estimated propellant that we had was about 160 meters per second, which again was about 22% of the annual cost, or of 22% of the budget of the previous two missions, the Prime and the Equinox mission. We used about 390 meters per second for the four-year Prime mission and about 210 meters per second for the 2.25-year Equinox mission. So going to the next slide, finally we get to kind of the get-your-hands-dirty portion of the talk, the actual trajectory design itself. So now that we know, you know, what our initial conditions are, we have an idea of how, you know, what kind of requested observations and defining all the constraints, we can now finally design a trajectory. So how do we do that? So moving to the next slide, we use gravity assist. What is gravity assist? It's a trajectory design technique that utilizes massive celestial bodies to change the characteristics of a spacecraft orbit. The main reason for using these is it enables the design and execution of very complicated missions that otherwise would be completely cost prohibitive in time and or propellant. Essentially, gravity assists are a renewable energy source that enables large variations in the spacecraft's orbit geometry. So in essence, a gravity assist is a trajectory design method that harnesses the energy already present in a system instead of bringing our own. So if we could bring in an infinite amount of propellant, we could do this with all these large changes in orbital geometry that you're going to see without gravity assist, but it's obviously very expensive to get mass out of Earth's gravity well and get it all the way to Saturn. So luckily we can use these gravity assists to do all the cool science. So the next slide looks in a little bit of detail about the Saturnian system itself. So there's 61 known moons that orbit Saturn, and Titan is clearly indicated by this graphic. It's by far the largest Saturnian satellite. It's 58 times larger, or more massive, I should say, than Rhea, the second largest. And given the high velocities that Cassini encounters the Saturnian satellites, Titan is really the only satellite massive enough to give significant alterations to the spacecraft trajectory. So moving to the next slide, so to quantify the significance of Titan for Cassini, a single 1,000-kilometer Titan flyby imparts a delta V in excess of 800 meters per second to the spacecraft. Of course, this is somewhat variable depending on the V infinity or the hyperbolic excess velocity, but about on the order of 800 meters per second. And this is equivalent to more propellant than we had at the beginning of the Prime mission post-periapsis raise maneuver. And again, just to hammer home the point, cumulatively, so we've had, I think, 74 Titan flybys now to date. Titan alone has imparted over 50,000 meters per second to Cassini. Of course, that's a scalar sum, not a vector sum. And so as a result, TORs are sequentially built as a series of Titan-Titan transfers. So even if we want to go visit another moon, say Enceladus or Rhea, the encounter has to be primarily designed to return to Titan, and you just design it to also fly by another moon. So there's three types of, or three basic kinds of transfers that we implement on Cassini, because again, we have to do Titan to Titan transfers. They're resident, non-resident, and pi transfers. Resident transfers, the flyby occurs at the same place in the gravity assist body's orbit, so the same longitude or true anomaly or however you want to define it. And so these orbits, since there's just two points, can be inclined. And so that's how we get a lot of the incline science, is using resonant transfers. The time of flight is an integer multiple of the gravity assist body's period, and we typically label them as the M colon N, so for instance, a 3-7 resonance, where the 3 would be the number of Gabius's body revolutions, and the 7, or the second number, would be the number of spacecraft orbits. Second or non-resonant orbits, these flybys occur at different longitudes, so we'll be going from an inbound flyby to an outbound flyby, or vice versa. These, because there's 3 points that define a plane, they restrict the spacecraft to be in the orbit of the Gabius's body's plane, which in this case, Titan's inclined about 4/10 of a degree. So essentially, it just means that the spacecraft's orbit has to stay within Saturn's ring plane. The time of flight is not an integer multiple of the Gabius's body period. And then lastly, pi transfers. So pi transfers is essentially a special case, an inclined special case of a non-resonant transfer. Its time of flight is an integer multiple of the Gabius's body period plus 1/2 of the Gabius's body orbit. And these typically have to be inclined. They're very dependent on the hyperbolic excess velocity. And these change the longitude of the Titan flyby by 180 degrees. So when we go from an inbound to an outbound Titan flyby, or vice versa, outbound to inbound, we're going to change where we encounter Titan by putting it on the opposite side of Saturn. And I have graphics for all these here in a second to kind of hammer home the point of how these methods are used and how they work. Before I do that, just let me go in a little more detail about a Gabius-Sis. So moving to slide 25. So by Newton's first law of motion, every object in a state of uniform motion tends to remain in the state of motion unless an external force is applied to it. So for this example here, if a particle or a spacecraft starts at point A with some initial velocity, at some time later it's going to go on this linear path and cross through point B with the same velocity. Moving to the next slide, now if we introduce some sort of massive moving body near this original path from point A to B, the spacecraft path is going to deviate and go to point C. And depending on how we fly by, the spacecraft flies by the body, whether it's above or below, behind or in front, the relative speeds, the relative distance, the spacecraft's orbit size, period, energy, inclination, or distance relative to the central body can be altered in some incremental and very predictable manner, such that we can reach these wide ranges of geometries that need to be reached for science purposes. So again, just to reiterate, I mean, this is something that's been known about for well over 100 years. It's been implemented in spacecraft trajectories for about 40 years now, and it's something that's very well understood. So this is the main technique that we use to change the orbital geometry. So moving to the next slide. So for resonant orbits, there's two ways to change the orbit characteristics. The first is referred to as pumping, and all that means is we're changing the spacecraft's energy. So if we fly the spacecraft behind the Gabius's body, we can increase the energy. If we fly in front of the Gabius's body, we can decrease the energy. And the second way to do that is change the inclination, or what we refer to as cranking, changing the crank angle. So moving to slide 28. So this is the first animation, so I'll give you guys a few seconds to load up the animation. It's called pumpup.mov. I'll give you 15 seconds, I guess, to load that up.
Yeah, that's good, Brent. I haven't got it going yet. So while we're doing that, does anybody have any questions? Some of these concepts are probably kind of foreign to people. Any questions for Brent? If not, people able to get the movie? Okay, I have it. It's a .mov file, so it runs under QuickTime for me. I have a Mac.
All right, so in this first animation, the top panel is, or actually both panels are just a view looking down Saturn's north pole. So we're looking, the equatorial plane of Saturn is the plane of the page, or the plane of your computer screen. The orbits of the 8 largest satellites are shown in white. Titan's orbit is shown in red. And then the spacecraft orbit, when you start playing it, is going to go in green. So what this is going to do is in this scenario, we're just going to simply use inbound Titan flybys to pump up or increase the energy of the orbit. So as this plays over time, you're going to see the orbits getting larger and larger and larger. So this is, we're increasing the period. In this particular case, we're going from a 32-day orbit to a 48-day orbit to an 80-day orbit, and then finally to an over 1,000-day orbit, a 70-to-1 residence. This particular case actually impacts Saturn because of perturbations due to the sun. But at any rate, you see how that we can vary the size of the orbit, the energy of the orbit. The second movie that we have here, it's called Crank Up. .mov. I'll give you a few seconds to load that.
Crank up one.
Sure. Whatever. Crank something.
Crank something.
So in this particular animation, now we're looking edge on to the ring plane, where the Saturn's north pole is pointed toward the top of the page. The bottom panel is a fixed position, so you're going to see over time how the inclination can change by changing the crank angle. But we're not really altering the energy here at all. And the top view is just a rotating view to kind of give you more of a three-dimensional feel. So as we let this play, it takes a little while to develop. You can kind of see that we start off in the equatorial plane, or the same plane as the satellites, and then over time we crank up the inclination. We're going to higher and higher inclinations. And so these two techniques, pumping and cranking, are used in various combinations. Typically, we're not doing just cranking or just pumping. We're doing them both at the same time. And these are the two main techniques, or the main two techniques that we use to alter the orbits and resonant transfers. So moving to slide 30. Okay, so this should be the last animation for a while. This animation is called Pedal Rotation. So what this is going to do is just show how non-resonant transfers can be used to change the orientation of the spacecraft orbit with respect to Saturn. So in this animation, again, as in the first animation, we're looking down Saturn's north pole. Again, the satellites are in white. Titan's orbit is in red, and the spacecraft's in green. And if you go ahead and play this, you'll see how we start off in a pedal orientation that's kind of pointed down into the left corner of the page. And over time, we're just going to use alternating inbound and outbound Titan flybys to slowly rotate the pedal around to a different orientation to get different geometries needed for science. This particular case is referred to as 2340 rotation. The smaller period of the orbits is 23 days. The period of the larger orbits are 40 days. And this, for the V-infinities that we have at Cassini, this is the most efficient way to rotate the line apsides, or the pedal. Another thing, non-resonant orbits, since they are in the equatorial plane, which is also the plane of all the satellites in the Saturn, or the majority of the satellites in the Saturn system, it's much easier to get targeted flybys of other of moons other than Titan. Since if the periapsis is low enough, we cross the orbit of each moon twice. That gives us a higher probability that we can, when we do cross that orbit, that the satellite is there. So non-resonant transfers are definitely used to get a lot of targeted icy satellite flybys. And then last, our pi transfers. This is an animation. It's just a figure. So again, Titan in red. And the pi transfer itself, the actual transfer, is in green. All the other white ellipses are just to show the complete cycle of going from an equatorial orbit, cranking up the inclination to get to the correct inclination for a pi transfer, and then pi transfers in green, and then the other side of the pi transfer where we crank back down to the equatorial plane. The big thing to note here is that when we start, the Titan flyby was on the right side of the page, and then when we, on the other side of the pi transfer, the Titan flybys on the left part of the page. So again, we changed the true anomaly or the longitude of the Titan flyby by 180 degrees. So we put it on the opposite side of Titan. So moving to the next slide. So obviously there's many, many choices at each Titan flyby. We have, for any given Titan flyby, we have just a huge number of different resonances. Do we crank up? Do we crank down? Do we pump up? Do we pump down? Do we try and go to the equatorial plane for non-resonant orbits? Do we do resonant orbits in the equatorial plane? Do we crank up the inclination and try and do some sort of 8-day or 16-day pi transfer? There's a ton of choices. And this increases factorially as the number of flybys increases. And for, you know, for a mission, the Solstice mission, that's going to have over 50 Titan flybys, this problem quickly overwhelms any attempt to solve the problem computationally. It's just too massive just to write an algorithm to optimize, to get as much science as possible. So that's where we, the tour designers, come in. I mean, we try and automate and have a, and design as much software as possible, but at the end of the day, we're still the ones at the helm making decisions each Titan flyby. And this, I mean, all these options are good and bad. I mean, it makes the problem very difficult. Makes the trade space huge, but it also gives us a lot of different opportunities. So how do we eventually end up with one trajectory? So just like planning, so going to the next slide, just like planning a month-long road trip or, you know, even a day at an amusement park or Disneyland, you have to come up with some sort of strategy based on preferences, you know, highest priority, availability of resources, and some sort of reasoning, you know, what makes sense to do first, last, never, which ones work together. And so we start to divide up different science drivers into different categories. This particular slide shows how we can divide certain scientific drivers geometrically. So some objectives can be fulfilled in equatorial orbits, again, like targeted icy satellite flybys, close Saturn observations where the rings are out of the way, et cetera. And then, you know, we obviously need inclined orbits to see the northern latitudes of Saturn, to get high latitude occultations of Saturn. And also, we need to use inclined orbits to get ground tracks that look at the northern or the high latitudes of Titan also. Moving to the next slide, this is just another way of organizing some of the key drivers. Obviously, I'm not going to go through this whole slide. Again, it's just the main point here is trying to come up with a strategy of what makes sense to do first, you know, in the middle of the tour, at the end of the tour. So this is just a plot of the Earth and Sun declination as a function of time. Just to give you an example, if you look down at the bottom, you see what Saturn looks like as viewed from Earth over time. So one of the main objectives in the Solstice mission was to get high-latitude occultation. So as viewed from Earth, the spacecraft going behind Saturn at high latitudes, and that's shown in that second Saturn figure where the two red lines are just meant to convey the trajectory going behind Saturn. And as you can see, if you wait too long, the rings obscure the atmosphere of Saturn, and you can't get occultations of Saturn anymore. So after about July 2013 or early 2014, the rings completely obscure Saturn. So it's things like these, it's trades like this where you say, okay, well, we need to do this first because otherwise we're not going to get it, versus the Titan South Polar coverage can wait, you know, until late 2014. So in this way, moving to the next slide, and you can just kind of flip through 35 through 38 at will, you can see that we can begin to prune this vast trade space by determining how to implement key scientific objectives. And so we build these little snippets over time and evaluate how different objectives fit with one another, which ones are complementary, which ones are mutually exclusive, which are cheap or expensive, both in propellant and time, and which make more sense to implement at specific times in the tour. So, again, just flipping through these slides, you can see we can begin to prune this vast trade space, but we're never going to design every single tour, even when we can eliminate certain paths. So again, it's dictated by us as tour designers, and really it's ultimately, I mean, we're under a time constraint, so the number of iterations are driven by scheduled deadlines. So while it'd be nice to iterate this many, many, many times. That just isn't possible because the spacecraft is flying there now, and we need to get something out the door so that we can start planning the science. So looking at slide 39, this is kind of the evolution of the trajectory. So again, initial tour design, we design all these little snippets or little pieces of trajectories that are built quickly with lower precision software that we developed, and they evaluate the efficiency and scientific quality of different routes. They can prove the existence of certain scientific observations and sometimes the lack thereof. So some of the things that the scientists want just aren't possible given either our limited Delta V budget or spacecraft spacecraft constraints, or just we don't have enough time to get in everything. From there, once we think we have a good strategy, we build fully integrated trajectories. So these are end-to-end trajectories that run the full 2010 to 2017. They implement higher fidelity models, and at this point they become flyable trajectories or candidate trajectories that if were chosen, they could be flown on the spacecraft, meaning the models that we use in these cases closely mirror reality. And then from there, we try and, once we have a complete tour, we then try and optimize it even further, where optimize in this case means trying to just squeeze out every little piece of propellant expenditure and also maximize the science opportunities. So tweaking ground tracks slightly so they go directly through the plume or go directly over Ontario Lacus on Titan, et cetera. And from here, we hand them off to the scientists. So about every 3 to 4 months, we release a crop of candidate trajectories to the scientific community, so the PSG. They then had a couple weeks to evaluate these, and based on their evaluation, meaning, what was good, bad, or ugly with each trajectory, design strategies were adapted for the next crop of tours. So obviously, as we further understood the vast number of science requests and how they kind of fit together, the design complexity increased over time, and really the design process hinged on this communication. It was kind of this ping pong match, this iteration process of the tour designers going off and working on these trajectories, thinking we knew what the scientists wanted, but at the end of the day, and thinking we hit the nail on the head for all these different objectives, at the end of the day, we still had to have the scientists come in, analyze the trajectories, and verify if we actually did get what we wanted. And if we didn't, then we learned why we didn't get them, and again, strategies were adapted. So like I mentioned before, the number of iterations were driven by scheduled deadlines. In the particular case of the Solstice mission, we had two different iterations with the scientists, and I'll go in a little more detail about that here in a second. So here's just kind of a summary slide just showing the entire design process. So again, scientific requests came in from teams, individuals, or investigations. Those were then filtered into the discipline working groups. From there, they were filtered into a large bin of scientific objectives, which were then given to us. We went off, designed a handful of candidate trajectories, gave them to the scientists so they could analyze them, give us ratings on all the different objectives. We then met with the scientists for a week-long meeting every 3 to 4 months and figured out what was good, bad, and ugly, and then just did it all over again. And then, so that's the process in a nutshell. Slide 42 just kind of gives you an idea of how and to what level some of the discipline working groups looked at these different objectives. They typically gave it a color code depending on how well the objectives were met, and gave each tour a final score so that you could kind of see which ones were the best. These are actually extended mission tours, but nonetheless, it shows you that some tours do really good at getting certain objectives and others do bad, and we try to take all the good characteristics from certain tours and expand on that. So it's kind of like being Santa Claus and trying to stuff as many presents in a bag as possible. So we're just trying to wedge in as many scientific objectives as possible in a finite amount of time and without breaking our budget. So slide 43 is just development summary. So again, the tour length of the Solstice mission is 7 years. We had about a little under 2 years to develop it, two tour designers. We had two iterations. So we released a total of 7 trajectories, so that's 49 years of tour that we released for evaluation. There's probably hundreds and hundreds of years of trajectories that were partially finished, or, you know, we went down one of those paths that ultimately didn't lead anywhere and had to start over or back up X number of Titan flybys and go forward from there. And so moving to the next slide, this is an animation, although you really don't, the slide itself really conveys what it needs to. The animation just, again, gives you more of a three-dimensional feel of what these trajectories look like. But so after, you know, 2 years of development, the project chose one trajectory. That's the purple trajectory, the Solstice mission. Again, it runs from October 2010 to September 2017. It includes 54 Titan flybys, 11 Enceladus flybys, 8 other icy satellite flybys, 155 Saturn orbits, and 206 planned maneuvers. So remember, moving to the next slide, that...
Brent, before you go on, what's the name of the animation that goes...
Oh, sorry. That animation is called Cassini... Oh, that's... You know what? That's the one that...
Never mind.
So it's called CassiniMission.mov. It'll be up there in a while.
Okay.
But it's, you know, it's just, it's not needed. It's just nicer than the bill figure. So remember, so moving to slide 45, hopefully. We had the Solstice mission trajectory design must also ensure that before propellant runs out, which would render the control of the spacecraft impossible. Action must be taken to definitively dispose of the spacecraft to minimize probability of biological contamination of both Enceladus and Titan. And obviously the scientists wanted, if possible, a disposal option that would provide unique science observations. So a number of, we worked with Purdue University and a number of different options were investigated, including various impact trajectories, long-term stable orbits within the Saturn system, and also Saturn system escape trajectories. And one overwhelming favorite end-of-mission option was a clear favorite in the scientific community, and this is currently baselined in the Solstice mission. So going to the next slide. So this is, it's called the proposed end of mission, because even though it's implemented in the baseline trajectory, which we're flying right now, this end of mission portion hasn't formally been approved by NASA headquarters, so we're still awaiting final approval on just that, this last portion. So what this is we're going to impact Saturn using short-period, highly inclined orbits, but prior to impact, we're going to do one last encore, which are referred to as the proximal orbits. So what we're going to do is place the spacecraft's vacant node, so the ring plane crossing that's not at the Titan orbital radius, within this 3,000-kilometer gap that we think is clear of any sort of debris between the innermost rings, the inner D ring, and the upper atmosphere. And so we're going to do this for 22 orbits, skirting the cloud tops at 34 kilometers per second. And on the 23rd orbit, with one last high-altitude Titan flyby, I think it's about 84,000 kilometers, we'll alter the spacecraft trajectories such that Cassini will impact Saturn 4 days later. So the big thing here is, well, one, it's going to provide a ton of unique science opportunities beyond the initial scope of Cassini. So no one really thought this was going to be possible when the prime mission was designed, and it was only developed a couple years ago, or discovered a couple years ago. So looking at the next slide, this really just shows exactly what's going on. So this is the animation called proximal.mov. I'll give you a second to load it. The top view is just kind of a side view of these orbits. The green are the F-ring orbits, so the penultimate transfer, the second-to-last transfer. The blue orbits that are going to be traced out are the proximal orbits. Titan's orbit is in orange. Enceladus' orbit is in purple, just to kind of give you a reference, a distance reference. The bottom left-hand panel is looking down the Saturn's north pole. So, again, the plane of the of your screen is Saturn's ring plane, and then to the right is periapsis profile. So if we go ahead and animate this, the proximal orbits, so all 22 orbits are going to slowly trace out. And the really the huge selling point here beyond the science itself is that we think this gap is clear. Scientists think it's clear, but meaning there's no particles that are going to harm the spacecraft. But obviously we can't be 100% sure. But the real beauty with this option is that once we implement this last Titan flyby, so we go from the F-ring orbits to the proximal orbits with one last close Titan flyby, the entire trajectory is ballistic, meaning no interaction from the ground system, from us, the navigators, and the spacecraft operations team are necessary. Essentially, after that last Titan flyby, from a navigation sense and the spacecraft operations sense, we can turn off the lights and go home. What's going to happen is going to happen. So even if we did hit a particle on that first ring plane crossing that completely paralyzed the spacecraft, it's still going to impact Saturn. It's still going to definitively be disposed of and preclude any sort of contamination of Titan or Enceladus. And so that's the huge selling point. But if the gap is clear, which we think it is, then we're going to get 22 phenomenal orbits that will shed all sorts of light on Saturn's rotation rate, Saturn's gravity, the ring mass. Yeah, the ring mass, the origins of the rings, etc. So I guess with that, I will go ahead and take questions after flying through 48 slides.
That was great, Brent. Thank you. Certainly, we must have questions for Brent. So speak up. Go ahead.
Awesome.
I hear some mutterings out there. Was there a question? So I was looking at slide 34, which is kind of an eye chart with the tour design strategy. That really puts it all together and reminds me of what everybody went through to analyze the tours and iterate with you guys. I presume JPL has got some you said using some sort of algorithm wasn't successful, but can you describe any more details about the attempts to automate a decision-making process regarding the tour? Or?
We did, for non-resonant equatorial orbits, we did come up with some brute force automation where you would give it some sort of initial conditions, and then you do all sorts of permutations of whatever inputs you gave it, different period orbits for non-resonant orbits, looking for a high number of IC satellite flybys. But that was really the extent of a true automation of trying to search for different scientific objectives. It was really more just us building a ton of different variations, one Titan to Titan transfer at a time, and then building up this huge catalog of different options and then looking at them and comparing them, working together, John and I working together and trying to optimize, giving them minimal, the small amount of time that we had. Mm-hmm. I mean, if we would have had more time, we could have built more.
Yeah. That really came, was clear in this presentation, compared to the prime mission and the first extended mission. You just really had to do this really quickly and with a lot less workforce. That was really interesting. I'd forgotten about that.
Yeah.
Were there any concepts that people wanted more clarification on? I know things like, the notion of delta V. And I mean, is that clear to people, or does Brent need to go into any more details about that? We got a quiet group today.
Yeah.
So is it all done, or do you have more design work to do before endo mission?
No, everything should be completely done. We're going to do reference trajectories every 2 years, I believe, but at that point, it's not changing, flybys, target points at flybys. It's more just updating ephemerity files and then maybe potentially moving a handful of maneuvers so that science observations can be placed there.
When do you expect to hear from headquarters about the possible orbits?
So just in case people didn't hear, Shadon just asked if when we plan to hear about the proximal routes if they're actually going to be approved. And, yeah, I don't have any sort of idea on that.
Yeah, I don't either.
I mean, the precedent's already been set with Galileo impacting Jupiter. I mean, from that stance, I think we're fine. It's just, you know, direct impact versus these proximal orbits. But, you know, we've done all sorts of Monte Carlo simulations where we take into account the uncertainties of you know, Saturn's GM, Saturn's J2, pole vector variations, everything that we track in on the navigation side from an orbit determination stance. We put in all that, you know, that a big, large covariance and did, I think it was 31,000 samples, Monte Carlo simulation, and every single one of them hit Saturn. And the variations on the flyby altitude were about 2 kilometers on the final approach into Saturn. And we're going in, I mean, our periapsis altitude, you know, as computed is like a negative 1,000 kilometers. So we're definitely gonna hit Saturn.
But what if that region isn't clear like you expect it to be?
Yeah. Again, so even if that region isn't clear, I mean, the entire thing is ballistic. So you set the orbits up correctly so that these these high altitude non targeted type flybys ratchet down your periapsis or slowly decay your orbit into Saturn no matter what happens. So there's no need for a maneuver from us. There's no, you know, this oh shit moment where, you know, we hit something, we can't control the spacecraft, and now it's going to go someplace we didn't expect it to. It's a premeditated death once the last Titan flyby is implemented.
Sounds grim. Premeditated death. What was when we originally thought about doing these proximal orbits at really high latitude? I mean, the first thought was, oh, we just can't do that. But then, after you guys started looking at it, you realized, oh, we can do that. What was, I don't know if you could even answer it, what was the additional piece of information, or what did you learn that made you realize we could do these?
So there's two major breakthroughs. The first was done at Purdue. So when they were looking at different, we farmed out some work to Purdue University, the aerospace department there. And one of the options they came up with was impacting Saturn with a highly inclined short period orbit. So because of the ring system, we can't just slowly move our periapsis altitude into Saturn. We have to essentially put our ring plane crossing just on the outside of the main ring system, and with one last Titan flyby, get it all the way inside the ring system. If we, because obviously if we traverse the main ring system, it's going to completely destroy the spacecraft, and who knows where it's going to go and decay. So the first big discovery was the fact that if you're in these highly inclined short period orbits, you can use one Titan flyby to jump the entire ring system to impact Saturn. So that led us to the impact Saturn scenario. The second major breakthrough that we made months and months later is, in certain geometries and certain resonances, and it has to do with whether the flyby is inbound or outbound, if the last flyby occurs at the ascending or descending node, and if the inclination is above or below what's called critical inclination, where perturbations due to J2 are minimized, you can find these certain geometries such that you get these ballistic decays into Saturn. There's other geometries, for instance, that actually do the opposite. They ballistically increase periapsis and go into the ring system. And then, so we had a handful of different geometries that we knew would ballistically decay into Saturn, and then from there, the PSG formed a proximal orbit working group, and, you know, we came up with, or you guys came up with a set of scientific objectives they want to see, and based on those scientific objectives that they would like to see, it whittled down the different options down to one option, which is what we implemented, which is the outbound Titan flybys at the ascending node to the descending node, or the when we cross the ring plane going down is going through the gap. So, but yeah, those are the two major hurdles, or the two major breakthroughs that we had to get to this point.
Yeah. And there's a whole bunch of really neat science that we're going to do, gravity science, the magnetic field, sampling the atmosphere. I mean, it's going to be really spectacular for science, as Brent mentioned.
Yeah, it really is kind of its own mission.
Yeah, it really is.
You know, if you look at the orbits, they're pretty similar to Juno's, actually.
Yeah, so
kind
Juno
of
resides
that after
yeah,
the fact.
Doing a polar orbit is going to be launched soon, and we'll do polar orbits around Jupiter. So, yeah, very similar to that. So any questions out there from our oh-so-quiet audience?
Yeah, I have one. This is Carrie.
Say who you are, too.
I know that it proved very difficult to get, I think there was an objective for an Iapetus encounter. What other science objectives were the most challenging for you to accommodate in the tour design?
Well, Iapetus was by far the most difficult and proved
impossible.
Not impossible. I mean, we had tour snippets or small trajectories that did get Iapetus flybys, but they flew by the wrong hemisphere of our site, did I say Iapetus? Yeah, we had chunks of tours, integrated tours that, you know, were flyable that got Iapetus flybys, but based on the scientific objective, they flew by in the wrong, you know, the leading hemisphere when it should have been the trailing hemisphere or something like that. So ultimately, we didn't release them. That's the one that sticks out in my mind. I mean, it's been a couple of years now since I went through all these, but that was by far the biggest or the most challenging, was trying to fold that in. And again, we could have probably modified it so that we would have flown by on the right side of Iapetus, but it just took so much time to get that it just wiped out a ton of other high level objectives, and it was deemed, I think, not really worth it from a PSG point of view.
Yeah.
I mean, I think given more time, we definitely could have found a tour that probably got an Iapetus flyby in there also. Just we just ran out of design time. Mm-hmm.
Any other questions? Okay, well, it sounds like we're done then. Thank you, Brent, very much. That was really interesting. Your slides are great. I have a lot of potential stuff I can steal now from your
graphics. Yeah, and I do want to reiterate, make sure you, because there are some typos in this original package that I presented. So just make sure, if you are going to use any data from these charts, make sure you download the updated version.
Okay.
All right.
That's great. So there should be a linked version that says updated on the website.
Yeah. Hopefully we can just have Kirk take down the old one.
Yeah, we'll get this all sorted out.
Okay.
All right. Thanks a lot, Brent. That was great.
Yeah.
So for our CHARM participants, we'll talk to you next month. We have Randy Kirk. He's a Titan scientist, and he's going to talk about cryovolcanism on Titan. He's made some recent discoveries that are really fascinating. There were a number of press releases at the AGU meeting in December, so I'll send out some links to that material, but it should be really interesting presentation. So that'll be in March, so join us then, and we'll talk to you next month.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you.